Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. Well, yesterday's chapter left us on a bit of a cliffhanger, and in the heat and excitement of the battle, so I'm pretty keen to read on. This is Book 3, Chapter 17. On our right flank, commanded by Bagration, at 9 o'clock, the battle had not yet begun. Not wishing to agree to Dolgorukov's demand to commence the action, and wishing to avert responsibility from himself, Prince Bagration proposed to Dolgorukov to send to inquire of the commander-in-chief. Bagration knew that as the distance between the two flanks was more than 6 miles, even if the messenger were not killed, which he very likely would be, and found the commander-in-chief, which would be very difficult, he would not be able to get back before evening. Bagration cast his large, expressionless, sleepy eyes round his suite, and the boyish face of Rostov, breathless with excitement and hope, was the first to catch his eye. He sent him. "And if I should meet His Majesty before I meet the commander-in-chief, Your Excellency," said Rostov, with his hand to his cap. "You can give the message to His Majesty," said Dolgorukov, hurriedly interrupting Bagration. On being relieved from picket duty, Rostov had managed to get a few hours' sleep before morning, and felt cheerful, bold, and resolute, with elasticity of movement, faith in his good fortune, and generally in that state of mind which makes everything seem possible, pleasant, and easy. All his wishes were being fulfilled that morning. There was to be a general engagement in which he was taking part. More than that, he was ordered orderly to the bravest general, and still more, he was going with a message to Kutuzov, perhaps even to the sovereign himself. The morning was bright. He had a good horse under him, and his heart was full of joy and happiness. On receiving the order, he gave his horse the rein and galloped along the line. At first he rode along the line of Bagration's troops, which had not yet advanced into action, but were standing motionless. Then he came to the region occupied by Uvarov's cavalry, and here he noticed a stir and signs of preparation for battle. Having passed Uvarov's cavalry, he clearly heard the sound of cannon and musketry ahead. The firing grew louder and louder. In the fresh morning air were now heard not 2 or 3 musket shots at irregular intervals as before, followed by 1 or 2 cannon shots, but a roll of volleys of musketry from the slopes of the hill before Pratzen, interrupted by such frequent reports of cannon that sometimes several of them were not separated from one another, but merged into a general roar. He could see puffs of musketry smoke that seemed to chase one another down the hillsides, and clouds of cannon smoke rolling, spreading and mingling with one another. He could also, by the gleam of bayonets visible through the smoke, make out moving masses of infantry and narrow lines of artillery with green caissons. Rostov stopped his horse for a moment on a hillock to see what was going on, but strain his attention as he would, he could not understand or make out anything of what was happening. There in the smoke, men of some sort were moving about, and in front and behind moved lines of troops, but why, whither, and who they were, it was impossible to make out. These sights and sounds had no depressing or intimidating effect on him. On the contrary, they stimulated his energy and determination. Go on, give it them," he mentally exclaimed at these sounds, and again proceeded to gallop along the line, penetrating farther and farther into the region where the army was already in action. "How it will be there, I don't know, but all will be well," thought Rostov. After passing some Austrian troops, he noticed that the next part of the line, the guards, were already in action. "So much the better. I shall see it close," he thought. He was riding almost along the front line. A handful of men came galloping towards him. They were our Uhlans, who with disordered ranks were returning from the attack. Rostov got out of their way, involuntarily noticed that one of them was bleeding, and galloped on. "This is no business of mine," he thought. He had not ridden many hundred yards after that before he saw to his left, across the whole width of the field, an enormous mass of cavalry in brilliant white uniforms, mounted on black horses, trotting straight towards him and across his path. Rostov put his horse to full gallop to get out of the way of these men, and he would have got clear had they continued at the same speed, but they kept increasing their pace, so that some of the horses were already galloping. Rostov heard the thud of their hooves and the jingle of their weapons, and saw their horses, their figures, and even their faces, more and more distinctly. They were our horse guards, advancing to attack the French cavalry that was coming to meet them. The horse guards were galloping, but still holding in their horses. Rostov could already see their faces and heard the command, "Charge!" shouted by an officer who was urging his thoroughbred to full speed. Rostov, fearing to be crushed or swept into the attack on the French, galloped along the front as hard as his horse could go, but still was not in time to avoid them. The last of the horse guards, a huge pockmarked fellow, frowned angrily on seeing Rostov before him, with whom he would inevitably collide. This guardsman would certainly have bowled Rostov and his Bedouin over. Rostov felt himself quite tiny and weak compared to these gigantic men and horses. Had it not occurred to Rostov to flourish his whip before the eyes of the guardsman's horse? The heavy black horse, 16 hands high, shied, throwing back its ears, but the pockmarked guardsman drove his huge spurs in violently, and the horse, flourishing its tail and extending its neck, galloped on yet faster. Hardly had the horse guards passed Rostov before he heard them shout, "Hurrah!" and looking back, saw that their foremost ranks were mixed up with some foreign cavalry with red epaulets, probably French. He could see nothing more, for immediately afterwards cannons began firing from somewhere and smoke enveloped everything. At that moment, as the horse guards, having passed him, disappeared in the smoke, Rostov hesitated whether to gallop after them or to go where he was sent. This was the brilliant charge of the horse guards that amazed the French themselves. Rostov was horrified to hear later that all that mass of huge and handsome men, of all those brilliant, rich youths, officers and cadets who had galloped past him on their 1,000-ruble horses, only 18 were left after the charge. "Why should I envy them? My chance is not lost, and maybe I shall see the Emperor immediately," thought Rostov, and galloped on. When he came level with the foot guards, he noticed that about them and around them cannonballs were flying, of which he was aware not so much because he heard the sound as because he saw uneasiness on the soldiers' faces and unnatural, warlike solemnity on those of the officers. Passing behind one of the lines of a regiment of foot guards, he heard a voice calling him by name. "Rostov!" "What?" he answered, not recognizing Boris. "I say, we've been in the front line. Our regiment attacked," said Boris, with the happy smile seen on the faces of young men who have been under fire for the first time. Rostov stopped. "Have you?" he said. "Well, how did it go?" "We drove them back," said Boris with animation, growing talkative. "Can you imagine it?" He began describing how the guards, having taken up their position and seeing troops before them, thought they were Austrians, and all at once discovered from the cannonballs discharged by those troops that they were themselves in the front line and had unexpectedly to go into action. Rostov, without hearing Boris to the end, spurred his horse. "Where are you off to?" asked Boris. "With a message to His Majesty." "There he is," said Boris, thinking Rostov had said His Highness and pointing to the Grand Duke, who, with his high shoulders and frowning brows, stood 100 paces away from them in his helmet and horse guard's jacket, shouting something to a pale, white-uniformed Austrian officer. "But that's the Grand Duke, and I want the Commander-in-Chief, or the Emperor," said Rostov, and was about to spur his horse. "Count! Count!" shouted Berg, who ran up from the other side as eager as Boris. "Count, I am wounded in my right hand," and he showed his bleeding hand, with a handkerchief tied around it. And I remained at the front. I held my sword in my left hand, Count. All our family, the Bergs, have been knights. He said something more, but Rostov did not wait to hear it, and rode away. Having passed the guards and traversed an empty space, Rostov, to avoid again getting in front of the first line as he had done when the horse guards charged, followed the line of reserves, going far around the place where the hottest musket fire and cannonade was heard. Suddenly he heard musket fire quite close in front of him and behind our troops, where he could never have expected the enemy to be. "What can it be?" he thought. "The enemy in the rear of our army? Impossible." And suddenly he was seized by a panic of fear for himself and for the issue of the whole battle. "But be that what it may," he reflected, "there is no riding round it now. I must look for the commander-in-chief here, and if all is lost, it is for me to perish with the rest." The foreboding of evil that had suddenly come over Rostov was more and more confirmed the farther he rode into the region behind the village of Pratzen, which was full of troops of all kinds. "What does it mean? What is it? Whom are they firing at? Who is firing?" Rostov kept asking as he came up to Russian and Austrian soldiers running in confused crowds across his path. "The devil knows. They've killed everybody. It's all up now," he was told in Russian, German, and Czech by the crowd of fugitives who understood what was happening as little as he did. "Kill the Germans," shouted one. "May the devil take them, the traitors." "Zum Henker dies Russen," muttered a German, which translates to the hangman with these Russians. Several wounded men passed along the road, and words of abuse, screams, and groans mingled in a general hubbub. Then the firing died down. Rostov learned later that Russian and Austrian soldiers had been firing at one another. "My God, what does it all mean?" thought he. "And here, where at any moment the Emperor may see them. But no, these must be only a handful of scoundrels. It will be soon over. It can't be that, it can't be. Only to get past them quicker, quicker." The idea of defeat and flight could not enter Rostov's head. Though he saw French cannon and French troops on the Pratzen Heights, just where he had been ordered to look for the commander-in-chief, he could not, did not wish to believe that. Again, there we have it, another action-packed chapter. I'm pleasantly impressed. I knew there would be some war action in this book, but you know, I didn't think that 150 years ago they were writing action scenes quite so gripping and so exciting. Got my heart rate up a little bit. So young Rostov again has shown his bravery, or his death wish perhaps, in this chapter. And Reddit user Garrock has asked a question around why Bagration has sent Rostov to do this suicide mission. Garrock said, "Although Tolstoy alludes to a childlike face, involuntarily transfixed with excitement and hope, as the reason Rostov was selected, do you think there was any other reason? Do you think Bagration feels any regret in essentially sacrificing Rostov for the ability to skip the battle blamelessly?" Sonic Vroom said, "I think Rostov was selected for the task of communicating with the Emperor because he was the only soldier present who'd rather meet the Emperor than live. Rostov also has already demonstrated his ability to venture off in risky areas and return. I don't think Bagration would grieve over Rostov per se, as Rostov just joined this squadron. But over the procrastination of a battle, I expect he regrets. The outcome of the French attack would have been different had they proceeded as devised." Sonic Vroom continued to say, "I think Rostov will understand the immense dangers traversed later, once he's proudly recounting these services. It should make him even happier to have risked his life, so, for the Emperor." De Fleury said, "I knew fanatical little Rostov had the look of a suicide bomber. I think Prince Bagration agrees with me, and that's why he picked Rostov to die on this mission, save the sensible and experienced soldiers for to fight another day. I agree with the other comment. Rostov will be insufferable after this, once he realizes the odds. But hey, author, I'll happily sacrifice his life if we can have Prince Andrew keep going in the story. It seems the comments are in agreement that they sort of chose Rostov because he's a bit expendable. But I didn't see that as the reason that Rostov was chosen. I don't think Bagration just saw him as expendable and, you know, get rid of that one. First of all, I think, you know, honor is a big thing and for military people. And to imply, there was sort of this implication that Bagration is sacrificing Rostov, as if that, you know, means he doesn't care for Rostov. But I don't think that's a consideration in war, because these men, to imply that they're not willing to sacrifice their life is sort of a great insult to a soldier. So to say, I'm not going to choose you for this job because you might die, it's not the way you approach a willing soldier. You need to give them the confidence to go ahead with the mission. And you need to accept that they want to risk their life. It's an honor for them to be chosen, so to speak. It would undermine Rostov as a soldier to not choose him because he might die. And I just think he looked around the room and caught this kid's eye and just thought, that's the guy for the job, for a few reasons. First of all, he's eager. He wants to fight. This kid wants to fight. Probably more than anyone else in Bagration's squadron, or whatever it's called. So the fact that Bagration's strategy at the moment is to not fight for a while, to hold back so that they can sort of clean up the mess, or, you know, he thinks they might be of more use if they wait for the battle to play out a bit before they rush in, maybe until the confusion starts to subside. Well, it makes sense to send away the one member of the squadron who would maybe disagree with that plan. He's so eager to fight that he wants to run in, so he might begrudge the fact that they're hanging back. So it would make sense to choose him for that reason. He wants to see some action, and he probably doesn't want to see all his comrades not fighting. And furthermore, it's probably just a case of knowing that, you know, of all the people in the room, who's most likely to approach this task with the greatest amount of bravery, who's not going to chicken out. And again, Rostov would be a great candidate for that. It was mentioned somewhere, it might have been in Brian E. Denton's write-up about this chapter, that previously Rostov sort of chickened out in battle and ran away, dropped his gun and ran, and that was when he injured himself. And now, when he approached this task, he was very brave and he just kept going and he approached the front lines. And at the one point, he got in front of the front lines between the those guys on the big horses and the enemy. But he kept going. He kept going and going. He was just fearless. I didn't see his previous battle when he bolted, when he ran off, as cowardly. I think he made the right decision there. He was completely outnumbered. He was standing alone in a field. You know, he'd been knocked off his horse, and there was basically an army approaching him, running at him, guns drawn. It was certain death. What do you do in that situation? You either die needlessly or you run away. And I think, I didn't see it as cowardly. I think he was scared, surely. But in that fear, he made the decision to run at that moment. And I think that was a good choice. If he was completely terrified, he might have just completely froze up and stood there and become slaughtered. Say what you will about Rostov, you know, he's a funny character, but I do love to see him in action in these battles, because he's just so fearless. It's kind of cool. Garrock asked the question, on a strategic level, how badly will this loss hurt the Russian war effort? Oh, a good question, and we really just have to read on to see how they recover from this. I think it was Boris, who Rostov ran into, who said they'd actually managed to push them back at one point. So I guess it's not all bad, But it did seem like there was a lot of confusion out there on the battlefield. Even Austrians and Russians were at one point shooting at each other. What a great chapter that was. I had a great time reading that. It was really exciting, and I hope the excitement continues from here. Thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.